on Straight Talk Africa, a look at the politics behind the recent postponement of a unity government in South Sudan. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing the political uncertainty in South Sudan. For the second time this year, the parties to South Sudan's peace agreement have failed to meet a critical deadline to form a unity government. However, they have agreed to a lengthy extension, and observers say meeting critical benchmarks could take months, if not years. My colleague Ian Deng Bior has more.
The latest attempt to form South Sudan's unity government is being delayed by at least 100 days. Political observers say increased dialogue and meetings between President Salva Kiir and Chief Opposition Leader Riek Machar could help move the process forward.
They need to sit down, develop a roadmap. That's what Civil Society Forum has called on. You can call it a retreat, a roadmap, but they need to sit down together continuously. It cannot be a one-off meeting for a day or two. They need to sit down continuously, draft the roadmap for how they are going to get to the actual new transitional government of national unity and start working together on making those events happen.
International pressure is mounting due to the second missed deadline this year. The United States, who threatened sanctions if South Sudan failed to meet the deadline, summoned its ambassador to Washington this week for consultations, announcing an intention to reevaluate U.S. relations with South Sudan. For its part, the South Sudanese government is pledging $100 million to fund the peace agreement. The reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission says there has been some progress in the implementation of the peace agreement. Stephen Ola says 32 out of 63 critical tasks have been completed, with others ongoing or pending, including critical security arrangements, which he says, if done correctly, could prevent a return to conflict.
And that is why I think what we as the monitoring body have insisted is that you need a very firm foundation upon which the other tribunal is established. And that foundation includes agreeing on some of the critical outstanding issues, the necessary unified forces, the number and boundaries of states. Certainly, we have had the experience of agreeing on a temporary arrangement, leaving out the bigger requirement in 2016. And the result was not very good, because sometimes political disagreement in Juba tends to permeate the security forces who would only read the lips of their politicians.
The additional 100 days was brokered in Entebbe, Uganda, earlier this month, in an effort to give the parties more time to resolve these issues. But researcher Madhav Joshi says South Sudan is trying to accomplish, in a matter of months, what took other countries years to finish.
For example, creating a new armed force in Sierra Leone, you know, took about 3 to 5 years, right? Even just, you know, for the demobilization of combatants in the Colombian peace process took at least a year to accomplish that. They are still in the reintegration process. It is, you know, they negotiated their peace accord in 2016, December. We are already in 3 years.
As the new deadline looms, South Sudanese civilians remain in uncertainty. The country has produced over 2.3 million refugees, while more than half of the South Sudanese people are severely food insecure. Ayen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Ayen, for that report. Joining us today in Washington are two distinguished guests. Philip Jada Natana, Ambassador of South Sudan to the United States. Ian Deng Bior, Washington-based reporter for VOA's South Sudan in Focus. From Nebraska, live via Skype, we are joined by Stephen Pa Kuor, Chairman of the National Committee of Foreign Relations of the South Sudan's People's Liberation Movement in opposition. And last but not least, from Boston, we are joined by Sarah Cleto Riar, founder and executive director of Global Partnership for Peace in South Sudan. I have to say that, ladies and gentlemen, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the four of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Sha.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. Let me
come back to you immediately, Ayene. First of all, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Shaka.
It's a pleasure, of course, to have you again on Straight Talk Africa after a very long time. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the key outstanding issues in as far as the September 2018 peace agreement is concerned.
Well, the latest report by the reconstituted JMAC says that out of 63 activities that are needed to be completed within the transitional period, only 32 have been completed so far. Now, out of those 32 are three major sticking points. There's the security arrangements, there's the training and unification of forces, and there's also the determination of the number of states and their boundaries. Now, there are delays in the cantonment and training of the 83,000 necessary unified forces. And in early November, JMEC said that it is unlikely that those troops would be trained and redeployed. And they recommended consultations between the parties to figure out the best course of action.
Why is it, why does it seem to be very easy, especially for President Salva Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar to sign these peace agreements? And yet, when it comes to the issue of implementation, they are missing in action.
Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure for both President Kiir and Riek Machar to sign these peace agreements, both from the regional community and the international community. But actually implementing the peace agreement, as we have seen in recent months, is another issue. I just mentioned the 83,000 unified forces that were meant to be trained and redeployed, by the first deadline and now the second deadline that was missed in November. So really, it's the agreement in and of itself, I think, is ambitious, but there's also pressure to just get ink on the paper to get the warring parties to sign the agreements.
How do you respond, Ayen, to some pundits who say that when they look at the deal between President Salva Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar, that it sort of reminds them of a couple planning a marriage while concentrating on divorce?
Well, I've heard that many times in speaking both with analysts as well as the South Sudanese people. South Sudan has been in war for years. And still there is no clear sign of a solution to the agreement. I think this current agreement, there's a lot of hope that it will work out. But of course, as you said at the top of the show, there's still a lot of uncertainty.
Tell us a little bit about the humanitarian situation.
The humanitarian situation is still very precarious. There is over 7 million people who are in need in South Sudan, and that includes over 180,000 internally displaced people. Right now, when you think about the peace agreement and, what is really at risk, I think it is the people of South Sudan. I was in Juba in September, and I heard from a lot of people who told me that they are unable to, feed their children or to eat three times a day and to really have a life that is capable of dignity. And so when we think about who this conflict really impacts, it impacts the everyday people in South Sudan.
As you know, Ayen, Uganda, if I remember correctly, probably holds the largest refugees from South Sudan. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And Uganda has played a major role in the South Sudan's peace agreement.
In fact, it also played a major role in helping to liberate South Sudan, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and President Museveni is seen as a close supporter of President Salva Kiir. Now, of course, that has raised criticism that because he is pro-Salva Kiir, that he may not be an impartial mediator.
I see. Mm-hmm. So if in fact that is the perception or the view of pundits and observers and what have you, why do they keep going to him to be the mediator? Why not some other leaders in the region?
Well, Uganda is part of the region. And as I said before, South Sudan does have that close relationship with Uganda. But there are issues that Uganda has been interfering in South Sudan's affairs. If you'll remember, in January, Ugandan troops were accused of entering central Equatoria. Now, the Ugandan spokesperson for the military told the Associated Press that the troops were there to help a team of engineers who were fixing a road on the Kaya Ye Road. But, you know, this brought up a lot of speculations because this was a potential violation of the UN-backed arms embargo on South Sudan. But this also happened at a time where there was a lot of fighting in central Equatoria. But Uganda, you know, has been mediating in some parts because they are part of the region. And the region has really stepped up in the last year to try to find a solution to South Sudan's peace agreement. If you'll remember, both the Ethiopian and Eritrean leaders came to South Sudan to try to move the process forward. The Sudanese have also played a role. And this is all happening at a very critical time for the region. As you know, there's protests in Ethiopia, and of course there's a revolution there was a revolution in Sudan. So this makes it a very critical moment, not just for South Sudan, but for the region as well.
Thank you very much, Ayen, for your insight. Let me come to you, Ambassador Natana. How are you?
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since we last hosted you. So tell us, what is the situation from your vantage point? Why is it that it seems to be very easy to append signatures on peace agreements and what have you, but when it comes to the implementation, these two individuals can't deliver, or at least can't seem to deliver.
Yeah. Well, thank you first, Shaka, for giving me this opportunity and for joining you again on Straight Talk Africa. And as we are discussing, we're having this discussion at a very critical time in the implementation of the peace agreement, with the remainders of the 100 days that we have to implement the peace agreement. As you are aware, the government has been committed, and I think I stated that very clearly in our last interview, that we were committed to have the government in place on November the 12th. But unfortunately, there had to be a postponement and extension by 100 days because the main opposition leader, Dr. Riek Machar, did not agree for the formation. He asked for an extension. So we saw that in order for us not to go back to war, the government decided to compromise on this and agreed to the extension that was initiated by guarantors, that's Sudan and Uganda. And in that meeting in Entebbe, the government of South Sudan, the president agreed that we could have another extension for 100 days with very clear benchmarks of implementation. And we see that we really have to implement this agreement, and the government is formed after that 100 days extension, so that we move ahead with the implementation of the other key issues.
Stephen Parr, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You listened to the ambassador. Do you agree with him?
Well, I disagree with him on only one thing. Maybe the ambassador has not read well the agreements. The agreement is an agreement of 8 chapters with 27 provisions. And to implement these 27 provisions, you have 110 activities, 3 transitional activities and transitional activities. You don't defer 3 transitional activities to transitional period. It will not work the way this agreement is signed. The letter of the agreement tells us that the periods of these agreements is divided into 2, 3 transitional period and transitional period. The reason why we demanded for extension is because we have implemented very little of the activities of the free transitional periods, particularly the security arrangements. You know, these agreements has two major chapters. Chapter one, power sharing. Chapter two, security. You cannot have a shared power without shared security, according to the letter of this agreement. So we did not just demand the extensions. We were just demanding implementation of the agreements in letter.
I see. Ambassador, I'm sure you have heard that. So what is the real deal here?
As you have heard it from the representative of the SPLM in opposition and looking at the critical issues that he had to sign, I think when we signed this agreement, the first thing that we actually were very much sure about is that we want to end the suffering of people of South Sudan. And the delay to the implementation of the agreement is very well known to him. And it's not that there's not a will, but I think we had issues of funding the agreement itself. You know, so security, as he said, is an issue of concern. But why are we behind and why are we delayed? It's just because we didn't have the funds to make sure that people moved into the cantonment areas, because if you looked at even the phases of the implementation of the agreement, the bulk of the funding is actually supposed to come from South Sudan. Yes, there have been some contribution from countries around the region, and there have been, but most of them are actually really, really token. And then the other issue that was also very critical, and I think he also didn't mention that there, is that some of these claims, big numbers of the forces of the opposition which they claim are there are not actually there, because most of these are really not professional soldiers as such, you know, who move from barrack to barracks, but most of these are like the White Army who are just being concentrated in Kettle Crown. And the challenge that is still hidden and people don't want to speak about that is that, you know, some of these forces are not actually willing to move from their areas, their home areas, and move to these cantonment areas. So we have to be realistic that, yes, there is a need that we stick to the agreement and we have to implement what we have signed into, but we have also to be very realistic that some of those challenges that we are facing are actually, you know, beyond what we can be able to do practically.
I see.
So, yes, can I respond to that?
Yes, please.
You know, the ambassador is contradicting himself here. First of all, he agreed that there is lack of resources. And the reason why our forces cannot stay in the cantonment is because in the cantonment, you don't have the shelter, you don't have food, you don't have the necessity that you need for human life. It's not because our forces are not ready. Actually, most of our forces have moved to the cantonment side, but many of them have to leave this cantonment side because in the rainy season, you don't have shelters. Again, as he correctly put it, the resources should come from South Sudan. I think as a party, as SPLM IO, we are ahead of the government. The registration that we have done, you can see that we have registered more soldiers than the government. So actually, we are ahead of the government in the implementation of the agreement. The problem, yes, is the resources. We have the will, but we don't have the resources also. Our forces are ready to stay in the cantonment. But look at where we are now. First of all, you don't even have the training centers ready, because the activities that should take place in the cantonment and barracks are as follows. You need to do the screening, registrations, selections, then you send the selected forces to training centers for joint training and joint deployment. Even the government has not completed part of the processes. Again, because of lack of resources. And where should the resources come from? The international community has not come in. The government is telling you now that there is no money. So how can we really stay in the containment camp without the necessities for human life.
Sarah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
What about you, from your vantage point? What do you think needs to be done, must be done, and is not being done at the moment, so that the agreement can, in fact, be implemented?
Yes. First of all, Shaka, I want to thank you so much for inviting me on this panel. It's really an honor also to be here with you and the other members on the panel.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as an activist and community leader, we are really concerned about this the agreement and being pushed and pushed several times. We believe that the agreement is in the hands of the or the implementation is in the hands of the government, and they are not implementing the important issues, especially in terms of the land or the boundaries of the states. People were even unsure whether the government was formed in if the government was formed in November on November 12th. Sure, so many community members who were fighting for their lands to be returned to them would not have gone back. So, and that would abrogate the agreement itself. So it's the ball is in the hands of President Kiir to really implement the agreement and take really serious measures in terms of the issue of the security for people to return. We have so many people, as Ayen has mentioned, displaced. People have been chased from their homes. For us, especially, I come from Western Bahr Ghazal, and our people has been affected not even in 2013, even long before that, in 2012, where the government actually attacked civilians. And people were killed in the daylight. Since that time, in December of 2012, the people of Western Bahr Ghazal are displaced. Their lands are taken. They are farmers. They are agriculturists. But you find that our neighbors do come with their cattle to farm on the land and destroy the livelihood, destroy the crops of the local indigenous people. So if all of these things are not resolved, especially the border demarcation of the boundaries of the states, which I think President Kiir is very reluctant, because the division of the states, 32 states, is divided to benefit one specific ethnic group more than over the others. And to change that is going to be something very difficult, which people are not sure if it's going to happen or we'll just continue fighting. And as has been said before, as President Kiir has said previously in 2012, that he's going to wipe the people of Western Bahr Ghazal out of the land or send them back to Central African Republic where they come from, or to go to South Sudan or to Sudan, to Northern Sudan. So people are going to continue fighting. If they don't have their land, where are the people going to go? So people are hopeful. People are tired. They want the peace. They want to go back to their homelands. But it's really very unclear if the implementation is going to be, even the 100 days is enough to implement the agreement. And if there's a will, because it's just a simple decision, as it was decided to divide the states in, to make 32 states, it can be a simple decision to return the states. As per the agreement, we need to return to the 10 states, and then from there, people can find out how many divisions they want to do later on. But according to the agreement that is signed by the government, that the states should return to the 10 original states when South Sudan achieved its independence.
Ambassador Natana, if you were to talk to me from the deepest bitter part of the bottom of your South Sudanese heart and soul, how do you respond to Sarah's charge that you probably do not really have, and she means the government by that, you do not actually have the essentially what she characterizes as the political will.
Well, thank you again, Shaka. And this is very interesting to listen to, you know, the allegations that are made by my sister Sarah. First of all, the government did not sign an agreement with itself, you know, so I think it really doesn't ring truthfully that, you know, it is for the government to implement the agreement, you know, because there are parties to the agreement that have signed. And I think that is the responsibility of everybody who has been a party to that agreement to see that they implement, you know, the areas where they're really concerned. So both the opposition and people in the government, I think they have a duty and a responsibility because they have signed that that agreement. I mean, if you looked at the issues that we have in South Sudan, and I think the most that are standing out, of course, is issue of security and then the issue of the formation of the state. First of all, let us be very realistic. Who has ever asked people in South Sudan how many states they want? You know, if it was the three regions that we had in the beginning in South Sudan, I think they were decided by the British. That is Equatorial Bahr al-Ghazal and the Upper Nile. If it is the 10 states, they were decided by the then government of Bashir. And when we signed the agreement, the CPA in 2005, that was not an issue at all that we have discussed until when South Sudanese started among themselves and, you know, asking whether, you know, we should have more states. It was a proposal of the SPLM-IO that they wanted 21 states mm-hmm. to revert to the 21 districts, you know, that was before. And then the government, of course, the
those were at least essentially the administrative centers when Sudan became politically independent.
It was 10
states. Was it on the 1st January 1956?
Yeah.
21?
Yes, yeah, but it's still, you know, the point that I wanted to make is that these were not decided by the Sudanese themselves, but the people of South Sudan have not been consulted about that. So I think that should not really be an issue because there is a very transparent process of the national dialogue in which now people from South Sudan are even asked from the grassroots level. Now, if you combine that as with part of the implementation of the agreement and you reach a point because even among the ministries that we are going to have as with this government that is going to be formed, there is going to be the Ministry of Federal Affairs. So I think that would be the forum actually whereby this issue would be addressed once and for all, and then South Sudanese will decide, you know, how many number of states that they want. So anybody here claiming that they are the ones who are giving the right, you know, the number of states to South Sudan is not actually making a false claim because, all of them, they have not been elected. They actually don't represent the views of the people of South Sudan. So they can't claim to be speaking for the people of South Sudan.
Stephen, how do you react to that?
Yes, you know, the government has been talking about 21 states of SPLM-IO. During the peace talks, it was the government that said we will maintain 10 states way back in 2014. So we signed that agreement in 2015 with 10 states. It is just like during the war with Khartoum, we had our own administrative areas. We called New Sudan in southern Sudan and southern Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains. But during the talks, we conceded that and we joined the government 10 states. That's what we did. So this should not always be used as reference. I agree with the ambassador that the people of South Sudan need to sit down and determine the number of states. Creation of a state should not be made by parties. It should be a legislative process done by representative of the people. Today, legally speaking, we don't have a legitimate government. The government of the day is de facto. We want
it's 13 hours.
A transitional government of national unity that will then in the process create a legitimate government where the people of South Sudan will elect their representatives, and it is in the national parliament where and the Council of State where the people of South Sudan can determine the number of states. It needs to be studied. You need to subject this process to the Eastern, and it can actually happen during the writing of the permanent constitution, where the people of South Sudan will now choose which type of federalism they will use, and if they want to choose unitary state, that will also come from them. But as we speak, the SPLM-SPLA-IO does not have a right to create a state, and the government of the day does not have a right to create a state. The people of South Sudan have not demanded those 32 states. It was just a political game to create geopolitical units, maybe for the parties to support, I mean to cultivate grassroots support. As for us, we are for 10 states. And during the meetings, the regions and the continents have actually joined us in this. This is state of South Sudan, the 32 states, are not viable states. Plus that, the boundaries of those states are so problematic. They need to be abolished so that our people also, you know, reconstruct the social fabric of their society. Because the boundaries of 28 states and 32 states have created permanent conflict among our communities. Those boundaries have divided people who have lived together for centuries and have created states that are not viable, tribal states. That has divided the people of South Sudan even more.
I'm afraid, Steve, time is not our best ally. You are tuned in to Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment. So please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, empowering people with disabilities, providing care, education, and growth opportunities is part of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. The International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are talking about the failure of South Sudan to create a unity government. Our guests are Philip Jada Natana, Ambassador of South Sudan to the United States, from Nebraska, live via Skype. We are joined by Stephen Park Wall, Chairman of the National Committee of Foreign Relations of South Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. And from Boston, we are joined by Sarah Cleto Riar, Founder and Executive Director of Global Partnership for Peace in South Sudan. Earlier, we were joined by Ian Deng Bior from VOA's South Sudan in Focus radio program. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, once again, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Yes.
Yes.
No, yeah, thank you again, and just to be back. So actually to maybe continue with where I've just stopped there. One thing that I think we need to correct, you know, my sister Sarah talked about the issues of, cattle and the issues of borders and all of these kind of things, you know. I think these are issues that are not just particular to South Sudan as a country, but these are issues that are all over Africa, and they become even exacerbated when you have a situation of war. Mm-hmm. And when you have a situation of war that weakens the institutions that are actually supposed to control some of these people who run around, who actually their activities are criminal by nature, you know. I mean, you can look at it even in Nigeria has the same issues, Sudan to some extent has the same issues, even Uganda, you know, with the Karamojong in the beginning and so on. But once you have a situation whereby there is peace, then you will be able to curb these excesses that sometimes result from people who rear cattle and who move. So to put that blame on the president of the country and saying that he's the one who is encouraging that, I think that's not really what reflects or what is really happening, but that should be just mere propaganda. And I think all of us need to work together to see that, you know, we try to stop this. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ambassador Natana, there was a very smart man by the name Professor Albert Einstein. He won a Nobel Prize in physics. He also had a great mind. He came up with the theory of relativity. He once said that if you continue doing the same thing over and over again, that must be insanity. Is it possible that we are probably looking at political insanity in Southern Sudan?
No, thank you again, Shaka, you know, for this. You know, I think it's not the intention that, you know, we have to do things, the same thing over and over again, as you referred to the renowned professor. But I think some of the challenges, I think that's what we need actually as South Sudanese, is that, you know, everybody has their own challenges, you know, but I think the best way that for us to be able to address these challenges is that really we should not use violence to advocate that. Because as you have seen in the report that was filed earlier by Ayen Bior and most of this international media, you know, in whatever we quarrel about, it is always the Sudanese, the civilians who really end up and who really pay the price.
Person is basically doing the suffering for you.
No, I think that's actually, if the suffering of these people can be lessened, and that's why we are very serious and committed to this, the government to be formed, so that we can actually bring peace to our people. So this is our concern now, you know, from our constituency, that we should not be, yes, as you put it, repeat the same thing again, but we have to move forward and make sure that, you know, we implement the peace agreement, you know, we form the government, so that we bring the suffering of our people to an end.
But what about the fact that, as people who are in charge of the government, you clearly hold a strategic position? For example, you have really not done much in helping to bring about the formation of a national army. That is at least according to a United Nations report. You have so far really registered very, very few troops, as opposed to the opposition, for example. Any particular reason why you can't do that? And there are reports which reflect some allegations, by the way, that in fact President Salva Kiir mired it with the commander of the National Security Services, have actually recruited very young children and young people in order to form a private army. They are estimating the number at about 10,000 so far. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, you put it that is an allegation, and it's good that you put it that way. You know, allegations can be propaganda, and people want to make, you know, there is no intention in South Sudan to form a private army, as some people allege, you know, that they, you know, maybe the government wants to form a private army that protects the president and so on, you know. I think mistakenly they are referring to the presidential guards, which I think most nations have got them, you know, even before the outbreak of the war in December 2013. I think these presidential guards were there, you know. So to refer to them as a private army, I don't think that there is a truth to that, you know. The issues of the implementation and the challenges that you clearly put, you know, I think, yes, you know, the government, of course, is the government, and it carries more responsibility than the opposition, than civil society groups and all of that. But I think we have said this time and again that the issues of the implementations and the delay in some of the implementations come back to issues of resources, because that is a real challenge there. You know, I mean, I can sit here in Washington, somebody can sit up in Canada and Nairobi and say, why are you not doing A, B, and C, you know? But when it comes to the reality of what is really happening, we have to really look at the situation in the country and the challenges that we have in terms of funding. Mm. And that's what I think are delaying most of these provisions. And by the way, actually, last week, the president has released, has directed for $40 million, you know, as part of the $100 million, and this is the second pledge that is already that is already going to the funds for the implementation. So that shows you our seriousness that, you know, as soon as funds are available, we will put it to the implementation of the peace process, and after that, then we will see what excuses will be coming up. Sorry. As the issues of the registration of the army on the side of the government, I think we are not starting to register the army from the beginning. You know, our issue is just to move them to the areas that have been designated, and then for people to verify. So our issue is not really an issue of registration and bringing in new people, but it's just an issue of verification by those who will be helping us to implement the security arrangement.
What about the UN report also says that or suggests that you are violating the peace process by dealing in what they characterize as illegal harvest of teak and mahogany timber. In fact, they say that both you, the government, and the major opposition.
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned actually a little bit earlier, is that, you know, whenever there are challenges that are based with the quick implementation of the peace agreement, the first party to blame will always be the government, you know, and I think that's why we always come out and we try to engage and actually really put the picture, the real picture that is there, so that those who, you know, are doubting or are concerned are able to know what is really happening. And and we take that responsibility very, very, very seriously, and because we think that the people of South Sudan owe their safety and protection to the government. And because of that, we are bound that we implement this agreement to the letter, such that there is peace in South Sudan.
I see. Sarah. Sarah, let me come to you. There was a very important lady in this town many, many, many years ago by the name Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of FDR, a man, of course, who served more than two terms in American history and eventually triggered the amendment of introducing term limits to the American presidential system. Eleanor Roosevelt has the distinction of having served as the longest first lady in U.S. history. She was a very, very smart lady and had opinions about a lot of different things. She's largely quoted by saying, for example, that great minds discuss issues. Medium minds discuss events. And small minds discuss people. But in this particular case, she would have said that no one can oppress you or no one can mistreat you unless you grant them your consent. Is it possible that the vast majority of South Sudanese have granted their consent to the South Sudan political elite to mistreat them? In other words, as one of my late friends, Professor Suleiman Nyang, would say, are we looking at Southern Sudanese as willing victims? Don't they have an opinion about what is happening to them in their country?
Yeah. Unfortunately, South Sudanese have been really cheated. They've been victimized by all of these conflicts. And it is the hope of South Sudanese that all of the crimes that were committed against them would be brought to justice. They should be addressed, and the perpetrators must also be must face justice. The people, they don't have a voice, and I hope that I had enough time also to respond to some of the comments from Ambassador Philip about even the process, the national dialogue process. I mean, that was that process was didn't involve many people. It was imposed by the government, and the government was the one that is overseeing it. We realized that not the people were not actually in the process of deciding what is it that they want or what they like. They have submitted their lives, and when I say that, because I know of women who have been victimized during this war. Women were raped, and rape now became like a norm for most women, because they have no way. And sometimes they use their bodies to be able to save the men in their lives, not to be killed. And the issue in South Sudan is it's no longer politics. It's just between right and wrong. What is right and what is wrong? What is the truth and what is the lie? We cannot just say here we have all of these reports, whether it's the UN, whether it's individuals, but come to the person like Ambassador Philip, who's representing the government, just to deny and say this is not true. These are people, they have suffered, and they are people who are expressing what they have gone through in their communities. And just to stand up and say that is not true, I feel like, yeah, you are, Ambassador Philip is really serving the government really well. But it's not representing the voice of the people, and I understand that it's your work to represent the government well, and whatever people say to say that that's not true. But again, as mentioned, the agreement you mentioned earlier, that the agreement is signed between two parties, and the other party should also be involved. And when we talk about the issue of the states, you came up and talked and said that people were not asked. And which people did you ask? You, the government. Which people did the government ask before they divided the states? People were not asked about that. And I mentioned earlier about the issue of in WOW, which happened in 2012 in December, about the counties and the municipality. People were not asked, and they at the end they tried to block the roads from the government to move to the municipal estate that the government issued, and people were killed in broad daylight. So South Sudanese, unfortunately, Shaka, we don't have any voice anymore. And we are not listening to one another. People are now fighting along tribal lines. And it's...
Very interesting, Carol.
And it's the system of that the government has built, dividing people along the ethnic lines, trying to create more loyalists from one tribe, or people who are loyal to the government from different tribes who are not serving their people. They're just serving themselves. But if we really are listening to the voices of the people, things would have been different. But we don't have any voice. We are not being listened to. I remember recently when the youth were talking about coming out and demonstrating peacefully, they got threatened. They were threatened that South Sudan doesn't have... South Sudan has live bullets. So kids were threatened to go out in the street, otherwise they will be killed, which means that we don't have a voice. And there's so many examples that I could share. I know we don't have enough time to share, but I hope that I have an opportunity to respond to some of the questions that were directly addressed to myself. Thank you, Shaka.
Thank you. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Shaka, I would like to just revisit your theory of Einstein, what you characterize as political insanity.
Yes.
I think what has been going on in South Sudan for the last 6 years is a political insanity. It needs to be fixed. And if you read this agreement was crafted to fix South Sudan. It gives the people of South Sudan a new national army, which is diverse, ethnically representative, the regionally representative of the diversities of the people of South Sudan, and it's set to create a disciplined, professional national army, which is nonpartisan, an army that will not be used by a party to politically intimidate others. It has given the people of South Sudan opportunity to write all their own constitutions, and it gives them a chance to elect their own leaders at the end of 36 months. It is good agreement. We just need political will from all the parties.
Yeah, let me come to you. We do have some technical difficulties that we're experiencing. If somebody were to ask you, Mr. Ambassador, that what are you fighting for, Southern Sudanese? How would you respond, really? Because let's face it, you have an incredibly beautiful country, remarkably fertile, almost no cultivation, really. I have had the opportunity to fly over that country twice. You have oil, black gold. You have other minerals and what have you. In fact, if there is anything that you do not have, are people. You probably could, in fact, implement a very progressive immigration policy of attracting your other African brothers and sisters come and help develop South Sudan. And yet, you are killing one another. What are you killing one another for? Because the last time I checked, really, every human being, regardless of which ethnicity, religion, gender, nationality, race they come from, they need three important things. If they are hungry, they need food. And food is an equal opportunity employer. It doesn't matter which tribe you come from. If you are thirsty, you need water. And all the time as a human being, you need dignity. What are you fighting for?
Yeah, thank you very much again, Shaka, for that very direct and elaborate question. South Sudanese are fighting today not because they want war. And I think the history of South Sudan, as you know, we've never had, maybe besides the 10 years of the Addis Ababa Agreement, the Southern Government,
yes.
That's when we had a government that has been,
been
in place.
Joseph
so
Lago.
We actually, people of South Sudan, are a traumatized nation. You know, they're a traumatized nation is because in all this period that people have fought, I think there has not been a space that has been allowed for healing.
Right,
you know, such that people come back, you know, that people come back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've said this before, I don't know whether it was here in the VOA and so on, that all of us as South Sudanese, I think all majority of us, we need to go through this this process. That was why after 2011 And if the government was, to set up strong institutions, then that process of healing should have been allowed so that people know. Because I think for all this time, even as individuals and I think and communities and so on, people, because of the culture that has developed over a long time, that has been subjected to people because of violence, that is what people easily resort to, you know. And it should have been actually the duty of the government, as you correctly put it, and when we create very strong institution, is to go and try to stop this. Because if you see, even in other places, let's take it, for example, in Ethiopia, you know, there is still this fighting of people between community and so on. But because at least their institutions of the government are firmly established, then they are able to go and address this by quelling the situation. So and I think that is what is different for people in South Sudan. But I think for it's not just that people of South Sudan just want to fight and they want to fight, you know. I mean, in fighting, yes, you know, even if some people claim that later on they are victorious and so on, but I think, the damages that are done by any fighting is actually more prominent than whatever little victory you can achieve for a while and you make yourself feel happy.
And for Ethiopia, if you don't mind, I think most reasonable people would agree that it has, at least for some time now, a progressive leadership.
Chaka, can I register my agreement and build on what the ambassador has just said?
Yes, please.
Yes, I cannot agree more with the ambassador that our nation is traumatized. We need healing in that nation. But we need leadership to do it. There must be a turning point. This agreement has a provision for transitional justice that has a provision for truth and reconciliation, healing, and accountability. Ultimately, those of us who have committed war crimes must go and face justice in the Ivory Court for South Sudan, which is stipulated in that agreement. South Sudan needs healing now, and it needs leadership that talk with itself, that dialogues. We don't have a culture of dialogue in South Sudan. Each time we try to dialogue, we fight. This need to end. This culture of war, the culture of the SPLM, SPLA, that dissent is rebellion. People do not just fight, and I agree with the ambassador. There is a tendency in Juba that those who fight just need to fight. No. What you need to create in South Sudan is an environment for dialogue, environment for healing, a political space to discuss politics civilly. We don't have that today.
I see.
Yeah.
Sarah, the last question, and time happens not to be our best ally also. If we were to be asked whether you are better off today than you were 5 years ago, what would you say?
It is really difficult today. I will not say that I'm better off when I'm living in the United States, and I know that a lot of things that happen divided the community.
Okay, unfortunately, on that note, today's distinguished guests were Ambassador Philip Jada, Natana, Stephen Parkwall, Ian Bior, and Sarah Kretoriar. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, South Sudan. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.